Oro, the all-powerful, the uniter of the islands. But in spite of the king's care, when the royal procession left the palace, the tall young courtier had to warn, "The August One already approaches the landing." Whereupon the king and all his retinue began to run, holding on to their various badges as they did. The king, aware of the ridiculous sight he presented, yet unwilling, through fear, to go more slowly, glared at the tall courtier whose information had been delivered late, and the aide, who was having difficulty keeping his tappa cloth straight as he ran, began to sweat and prayed beneath his breath, "If there is to be a convocation, O gods of Bora Bora, spare me." The king stumbled on in the hot morning sun, angry, muttering, damaged in pride. But he did reach the landing place a few moments before the canoe, and although he could not have known it at the time, his sweaty embarrassment helped rather than hurt. For from the outrigger, the high priest noticed with satisfaction the king's discomfort, and for a moment allowed a smile to creep toward his lips. But it was quickly suppressed, and the priest resumed his aloof study of the mountain peak. Gently, the steersman brought his canoe to rest, careful lest any untoward accident draw the priest's attention, for the paddlers knew what message the religious man was bringing from the Temple of Oro, and on this day it behooved all men to be careful. When the canoe was secured, the high priest disembarked with imperial dignity, his white bark cape with its fringe of dog's teeth shining against his long black hair. He was a powerful symbol of Oro as he moved with his god-carved staff to meet the king, genuflecting slightly as if to indicate that he acknowledged the latter's supremacy. Then, recovering his posture, he waited grimly, while King Tamatoa, the supposed ruler, bowed low and held a subservient position long enough to impress all witnesses with the fact that power had somehow been mysteriously transferred from his hands into those of the priest. Then the king spoke. "O blessed of the gods," King Tamatoa began, "what is the wish of Oro?" The pressing crowd, handsome men and fine women, naked to the waist and dark-eyed, held its breath in apprehension, which the high priest sensed and relished. He waited, while soft winds from the green lagoon tugged at palms that lined the shore and made the dark green leaves of breadfruit sway. Then he spoke solemnly. "There will be a convocation." No one gasped, lest he draw fatal attention to himself. The high priest continued, "A new temple is to be erected in Tahiti, and we shall convene to consecrate the god who is to live in that temple." He paused, and visible fear crept over the faces of his listeners. Even King Tamatoa himself, who could with reasonable assurance count on being spared, felt his knees weaken while he waited for the dread details that completed any announcement of a general inter-island convocation at Oro's temple. But the high priest also waited, appreciating that the longer his terror continued, the more effective it would be in impressing the sometimes recalcitrant Bora Borans with the temper and might of their new god. On this day he would maneuver the king himself into asking the fatal questions. Flies that had been feeding on dead fish along the lagoon shore now turned their attention to the bare backs of the waiting crowd. But no man moved, lest in the next dreadful moments he become conspicuous. The king waited. The priest waited. Finally, in a hushed voice, Tamatoa asked, "When is the convocation?" "Tomorrow," the high priest said sternly, and his news was instantly interpreted as he had intended. Thought the king, "If the convocation is to be tomorrow, it must have been decided upon 10 days ago. Else how could the news reach Tahiti in time for their canoe to return to Hawaiki tomorrow? Our high priest must have been in secret consultation with the priests of Oro during all those 10 days. The flies stung perspiring backs, but no man moved, awaiting the next ominous question. Finally, Tamatoa asked, "How many men for Oro?" 8, the priest replied impersonally. Placing his staff before him, causing watchers in the muted crowd to fall back, the gaunt, dark man in shimmering white robes moved off toward his temple. But when it appeared that he had finished with the crowd, he suddenly whirled about, made a terrifying sound in his throat, and thrust his staff directly at the steersman who had brought him into the safety of the lagoon. "And this one shall be first," he screamed. "No, no," the steersman pleaded, falling to his knees on the sand. Implacably, the great, gaunt priest towered over him, pointing at him with the staff. "When the seas were upon us," he intoned mournfully, "this one prayed not to Oro for salvation, but to Tane." "Oh, no," the sailor pleaded. "I watched his lips," the priest said with awful finality. Attendants from the temple gathered up the quaking steersman and hauled him off, for his legs, surrendering to terror, could not be forced to work. "And you," the dreadful voice cried again, thrusting his staff at an unsuspecting watcher. "In the temple of Oro on the holy day, your head nodded. You shall be second." Once more, the attendants closed in on the culprit, dragging him away, but gently, lest Oro be offered as a human sacrifice, a man who was bruised or in any way imperfect. Solemnly, the high priest withdrew, and King Tamatoa was left with the miserable task of nominating the 6 additional human sacrifices. He asked, "Where is my aide?" And from a spot toward the rear of the crowd where he had hoped to remain unnoticed, the tall and trembling courtier stepped forth. "Why was I late in greeting the Sacred One?" the king demanded. "The lookout stumbled. It was he who was tardy," the aide explained. From the rear of the crowd, a woman's voice inadvertently blurted, "No, that is not true." But the woman's husband, a small man of no marked intelligence, was dragged before the king, where he shook like a torn banana leaf, and the king surveyed him with disgust. "He shall be third," the king commanded. "Oh, please, no," the lookout protested. "I ran true, but when I reached the palace," and he pointed to the aide, "he was asleep." The king recalled his earlier impatience with the young courtier and announced peremptorily, "He shall be fourth. The rest shall be taken from the slaves." With this, he strode back to the palace, while the lookout and the tall courtier, already pinioned by the priests, stood in limp amazement, appalled by the catastrophe in which each had so accidentally involved the other. As the frightened crowd dispersed, each congratulating himself that for this convocation he had escaped the insatiable hunger of Oro, a young chief, clothed in golden tappa, which indicated that he was of the royal family, stood bitter and silent in the shade of a breadfruit tree. He had not hidden himself through fear, for he was taller than most, better muscled than any, and marked by a lean, insolent courage that no man could mistake. He had remained apart because he hated the high priest, despised the new god Oro, and was revolted by the incessant demand for human sacrifice. The high priest, of course, had immediately detected the young chief's absence from the welcoming throng, a breach of conformity which so enraged him that during the most solemn part of the ceremony, his penetrating gaze had flashed this way and that, searching for the young man. Finally, the priest had found him, lounging insolently under the breadfruit tree, and the two men had exchanged long, defiant stares that had been broken only when a golden-skinned young woman with flowing hair that held banana blossoms tugged at her husband's arm, forcing him to drop his eyes. Now, with the ceremony ended, the stately wife was pleading, "Tiroro, you must not go to the convocation." "Who else can command our canoe?" he asked impatiently. Is a canoe so important? Her husband looked at her in amazement. Important? What could there be more important? Your life, she said simply. Wise navigators do not sail when the clouds are ominous. He dismissed her fears and strode disconsolately to a fallen log that projected into the lagoon. Falling angrily upon it, he dipped his brown feet into the silvery waters and kicked them viciously as if he hated even the sea. But soon his placid wife, lovely in the fragrance of banana blossoms, came and sat beside him, and when her feet splashed in the cool green waters, it was as if a child were playing, and soon her husband forgot his anger. Even when he stared across to the small promontory on which the local temple sat, and where the priests were dedicating the 8 doomed men to Oro, he spoke without the animal anger that had possessed him during the ceremonies. I'm not afraid of the convocation, Marama, he said firmly. I am afraid for you, his wife replied. Look at our canoe, he digressed, pointing to a long shed near the temple, under which a mammoth twin-hulled canoe rested. You wouldn't want anyone else to guide that, would you? He teased. Marama, whose priestly father had selected the sacred logs for the craft, needed no reminder of its importance. So she contented herself with pointing out, Mato from the north can guide the canoe. Then Tororo divulged his real reason for attending the dangerous convocation. My brother may need my help. King Tamatoa will have many protectors, Marama replied. Without me, events could go badly, Tororo stubbornly insisted. And wise Marama, whose name meant the moon, all-seeing and compassionate, recognized his mood and retreated to a different argument. She said, Tororo, it is you mainly that the high priest suspects of being disloyal to his red god Oro. No more than the others, Tororo growled. But you're the one who shows your disbelief, she argued. Sometimes I can't hide it, the young chief admitted. Furtively, Marama looked about to see if any spy had crept upon them, for the high priest had his men in all places. But today there was none, and with her feet in the lagoon, she resumed her careful reasoning. You must promise me, she insisted, that if you do go to Oro's temple, you will pray only to Oro, think only of Oro. Remember how the steersman's lips were red. I've been to 3 convocations at Hawaiki, Tororo assured her. I know the dangers. But not this special danger, his wife pleaded. What is different? He asked. Again Marama looked about her, and again she saw nothing, so she spoke. Haven't you wondered why the high priest spent 10 extra days at Hawaiki? I suppose he was preparing for the convocation. No. That must have been decided many days earlier. To permit canoes from Tahiti and Morea to return to Hawaiki by tomorrow. Last year, a woman from Hawaiki confided to me that the priests there consider our high priest the ablest of all, and they plan to promote him to some position of prominence. I wish they would, Tororo grumbled. Get him off this island. But they wouldn't dare make him paramount priest so long as his own island is not completely won over. As Marama talked, her husband began to pick up a thread of importance which often occurred when the wise, moon-faced woman spoke, and he leaned forward on the log to listen. She continued, It seems to me that the high priest will have to do everything possible in this convocation to prove to the priests of Hawaiki that he is more devoted to Oro than they. In order to make himself eligible for promotion? Tororo asked. He must. What do you think he will do? Tororo asked. Marama hesitated to utter the words, and at that moment an unexpected wind blew across the lagoon and threw small waves at her feet. She drew her toes from the lagoon and dried them with her hands, still not speaking. So Tororo continued her thought. You think that to impress others the high priest will sacrifice the king? No, Marama corrected. It is your feet he will place upon the rainbow. Tororo reached up and tugged at the tip of a breadfruit leaf and asked thoughtfully, Will the killing then stop? No, his wife replied gravely. It will go on until all of your friends have left the lagoon. Only then will Bora Bora be safe for Oro. Men like Mato and Pa? They are doomed, Marama said. But you think not the king? No, the queenly young woman reasoned. Your brother is well loved by the kings of Tahiti and Morea, and such a bold step might turn not only those kings but people in general against the new god. But offering me to Oro would be permitted? Tororo pursued. Yes. Kings are always willing to believe the worst of younger brothers. Tororo turned on the log to study his beautiful wife and thought to himself, I don't appreciate her good sense. She's a lot like her father. Aloud, he said, I hadn't reasoned it out the way you have, Marama. All I knew was that this time there was special danger. It is because you, the brother of the king, still worship Tani. Only in my heart do I do that. But if I can read your heart, Marama said, so can the priests. Tororo's comment on this was forestalled by an agitated messenger, his arm banded by a circle of yellow feathers to indicate that he belonged to the king. We have been looking for you, he told Tororo. I've been studying the canoe, the young chief growled. The king wants you. Tororo rose from the log, banged his feet on the grass to knock away the water, and nodded an impersonal farewell to his wife. Following the messenger, he reported to the palace, a large, low building held up by coconut tree pillars, each carved with figures of gods and highly polished so that white flecks in the wood gleamed. The roof consisted of plaited palm fronds, and there were no floors or windows or side walls, just rolled-up lengths of matting, which could be dropped for either secrecy or protection from rain. The principal room contained many signs of royalty. Feather gods, carved shark's teeth, and huge tridacna shells from the south. The building had two beautiful features. It overlooked the lagoon, on whose outer reef high clouds of spray broke constantly, and all parts of the structure were held together by thin, strong strands of golden-brown sennit, the marvelous island rope woven from fibers that filled the husks of coconuts. Nearly 2 miles of it had been used in construction. Wherever one piece of timber touched another, pliant golden sennit held the parts together. A man could sit in a room tied with sennit and revel in its intricate patterns, the way a navigator studies stars at night, or a child tirelessly watches waves on sand. Beneath the sennit-tied roof sat King Tamatoa, his big, broad face deeply perturbed. Why has a convocation been called? He asked peremptorily. Then, as if fearing the answer, he quickly dismissed all who might be spies. Drawing closer on the tightly woven mat that formed the floor, he placed his two hands on his knees and asked, What does it mean? Tororo, who did not see things quickly himself, was not above reciting his wife's analyses as his own, and now explained, It looks to me as if our high priest must be seeking promotion to the temple in Habaiki, but in order to be eligible, he has to do something dramatic. He paused ominously. Like what? The king asked. Like eliminating the last signs of Tani worship in Bora Bora. Like sacrificing you at the height of the convocation. I'm fearful of just such a plot, Tamatoa confessed. If he waits till we're in convocation, he could suddenly point at me the way they pointed at our father, and... The troubled king made a slashing swipe at his brother's head, adding dolefully, And my murder would be sanctified because Oro had ordained it. More likely the high priest, Tororo corrected. Tamatoa hesitated, as if probing his younger brother's mind, and then added petulantly, and my death would go unavenged. Self-pity was so alien to Tamatoa, whose warlike capacities and prudent leadership had kept little Bora Bora free from invasion by its larger neighbors, that Tororo suspected his brother of laying some kind of trap. So the younger man fought down his inclination to confess his own plans for the convocation and observed idly, "The canoe will be launched at noon." "Will it be ready by sunset?" the king asked. "It will, but I hope you won't be on it." "I am determined to go to this convocation," Tamatoa replied. "Only evil can befall you," Tororo insisted. The king rose from his mats and walked disconsolately to the palace entrance, from which he could see the majestic cliffs of Bora Bora and the sun-swept lagoon. "On this island," he said with deep emotion, "I grew in joy. I have always walked in the shadow of those cliffs and with those waves clutching at my ankles. I have seen the other islands, and the bays of Morea are lovely. The crown at Tahiti is good to see, and the long beaches of Hawaiki. But our island is man's heaven on earth. If I must be sacrificed to bring this island into harmony with new gods, then I will be sacrificed." The images evoked by Tamatoa's memories of the Bora Bora of their youth accomplished what his guile had been unable to do, and Tororo cried, "Brother, do not go to Hawaiki." "Why not?" Tamatoa asked, flashing around and moving back to the mats. "Because your departure to the gods will not save Bora Bora." "Why not?" Tamatoa demanded, thrusting his face close to Tororo's. "Because when the club falls, I shall kill the high priest. I will rage through all Hawaiki and destroy it. Then the other islands will destroy us." "As I thought," the king cried sharply. "You have a plan to riot. Oh, Tororo, it will accomplish nothing. You cannot go to the convocation." "I will be there," Tororo muttered stubbornly. The king stood grave in the morning shadows and pointed his right forefinger at Tororo. "I forbid you to leave Bora Bora." At this moment, the warrior king Tamatoa, burly and serious-faced, was a symbol of overpowering authority to his younger brother, and the projecting finger almost made Tororo tremble. For although he wanted to grasp his brother by that finger, and then by his hand, and finally by his strong arm, and thus pull him down onto the mats for an honest conversation, the young chief could never have brought himself to touch the king, because he knew that the king was the instrumentality whereby the gods delivered manna, the spiritual sanctification of the heavens, to Bora Bora. And even to touch a king, or pass upon his shadow, was to drain away some of that manna, and thus imperil not only the king, but the entire society. Yet Tororo's desire for words with his brother was so great that he prostrated himself on the matting, crept on his belly to him, and pressed his face close to the king's feet, whispering, "Sit with me, brother, and let us talk." And while the flies droned in morning heat, the two men talked. They were a handsome pair, separated in age by 6 years, for a sister had been born between, and each was aware of the special bond that linked him to the other, for as boys their wrists had been opened one solemn day, and each had drunk the blood of the other. Their father, dead as a sacrifice to Oro, had named his first son Tamatoa, the warrior. And then, when a younger brother was